Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I begin by joining with the Leader of the Opposition in traditional way in offering my warm congratulations to my honourable friends, the mover and seconder of the motion on the gracious speech. My honourable friend, the member for Devon West and Torridge, who moved it, succeeded in his warmth and profound speech in bringing to us something of the spirit of Devon, where his family and his farming roots lie. He served in two government posts in the 70s. First, he was Parliamentary Secretary at the Ministry of Agriculture, bringing to his work there the skills and insights of a practical farmer. Then he served in the Northern Ireland office, where it was not only his knowledge of farming, but also his profound religious sympathies and sensitivities that enabled him to make a very special and well-remembered contribution in the province. Since then, his broad spectrum of parliamentary duties and current offices, ranging from the vice-chairmanship of the Commonwealth Parliamentary Association to the chairmanship of the Houses of Parliament Christian Fellowship, has turned him almost into a one-man institution in this House, widely respected and warmly regarded in every part of it. We are grateful. We are grateful to him for his speech. I also pay tribute to the speech made by my honourable friend, the member for Crosby, in seconding the address. He is Merseyside born and bred, and his enthusiasm and his understanding of that region and its people did come through vividly in his speech. He has the unique distinction of having served for over 20 years as a senior Liverpool River pilot. And he left that job to enter this House in 1979, and this time contested Crosby. And thereby some extremely skillful and effective navigation, he steered his electoral craft safely to port at Westminster. I believe that like his great Conservative predecessor, the late Sir Graham Page, he will be based on this parliamentary port for many years to come. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, I listened carefully to the speech of the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Leader of the Opposition. It seemed to me, listening to him, that our procedures had scarcely been interrupted by an election. But I would just gently remind the Right Honourable Gentleman that he did put that message during the election, and that the people totally and utterly rejected it. He spoke about unemployment. Indeed, I shall do the same. But not one word, he said, would have created one extra job. One extra job that would have created any extra wealth in this country. It is easy to speak about the tragedies of unemployment. What we have to do is to try to seek ways of alleviating it and creating genuine wealth and genuine jobs in this country. He spoke also about pensioners. May I remind him that the pension now is at a higher real level than during the lifetime of the last Labour government, and that during a recession. He spoke also about the National Health Service. May I again remind him there are more doctors and nurses and patients treated in the National Health Service now than when he left office. He spoke also about relations between East and West, strictly on the basis of nuclear accountancy. I so hope to put them in a much wider context than that. He spoke about joint decision on the use of crews when they are deployed in this country. These matters were reviewed before the election in relation to crews, and the answer was given in a full parliamentary reply shortly before the election. The President in the United States was asked about it. Did it mean that Britain would have a veto on the deployment of those weapons, on the firing of those weapons, to which he replied, yes. Actually, it goes deeper than that. no such decision would ever be made without it being made jointly. It is, in fact, deeper than a veto. But, Mr. Speaker, in this debate, the House will want to do more than repeat the debates of the general election. Well, the opening of a new Parliament is an occasion to look to the future. And two of the most serious challenges that we face are set out in the first sentence of the gracious speech, which deals with domestic policies. The first sentence of that part dealing with domestic policies. It says, "My government will pursue policies designed to increase economic prosperity and to reduce unemployment."
Is the Prime Minister aware that one of the reasons why she managed to get a majority is because they had the powerful aid of the media and the press in general? And that same media told them that the Tory policy on mortgage rates was to keep them down, and a lot of people now know today that the Tory policy on mortgages has been shot to ruins because all that collaboration between her supporters and the people in the building societies has now been proved to be false as a result of the massive increase of 1.25% today.
Mr. Speaker, the media may take the voices across the air to reach the electorate, but it was the Right Honourable Gentleman's message that was rejected. And with regard to mortgage rates, yes, I do not disguise my disappointment that mortgage rates have been put up. Especially as interest rates were reduced in the middle of April, first to 10%, and since the election, base rates have been reduced to 9.5%, only 0.5% above what they were when the present mortgage rates were fixed. Therefore, of course, I'm disappointed they have been put up by 1.25%. We understand, nevertheless, the reasons which have led them to do so is being that the demand for mortgages is so great that they must get in more savings to meet that demand, because Tory governments give greater opportunities for home ownership than Labour would ever have done. But, Mr. Speaker, if I may come back to discussing what I believe to be the main concern of this House and people outside, unemployment. It's a symptom, the most painful symptom, of the fundamental problems which this country has long faced. It is the result of failure to compete, of pay well above anything justified by output, of restrictive practices, of past inflation. And on top of these problems, we, like other countries, have suffered from the deepest world recession since the war. When this government took office 4 years ago, we made it clear that the problems of decades could not be solved in the lifetime of one Parliament. But we've addressed ourselves to those fundamental problems, and by the end of our first term, we had brought inflation down to its lowest level since 1968. And as figures published in the few days since the election show, production is rising and productivity has reached new record levels. Retail sales are going up, and the underlying increase in average earnings is lower than at any time since 1969. And we have achieved those things without resort to wage or price controls, which at best have a limited life and only store up trouble for the future. But, Mr. Speaker, we have also to consider our performance against that of our competitors. Because even at 3.7%, our inflation is still higher than in Germany, the Netherlands, or Japan. Therefore, we must follow policies which will reduce inflation still further. The underlying increase in average earnings is still too high in relation to what we produce, and too high compared with the performance of our competitors. So we cannot weaken our efforts if industry and commerce are to compete with the rest of the world and gain prosperity and jobs in Britain. And we shall only gain prosperity and jobs in Britain if we can compete with the rest of the world. Yes. Indeed, the increase in imports of manufactured goods to which the Right Honourable Gentleman referred sounds the same warning. There is plenty of demand in this country, and it is up to British industry to produce the right goods to meet it. Yeah, yeah, yeah. We can't afford to relax in the belief that the end of an economic cycle will automatically bring recovery. It can't, and it never did. Moreover, we reject the view held by honourable members opposite that governments can ordain a sustainable growth in activity in the economy, whether by massive expansion of public borrowing or by printing money. But the government has indeed an important, indeed a vital role, and it is to create the conditions and framework which encourage recovery and growth to take place, and which, if sustained, will lead to the generation of new jobs. How fast this will happen will depend both on world conditions and on how well people identify and seize the new opportunities. Mr. Speaker, we shall pursue our strategy for recovery and jobs, first, by helping business to cut costs. And we can do this through following sound financial policies which keep inflation down and help to keep interest rates down. We can and are doing it through reducing taxation on business, and we hope finally to abolish Labour's pernicious tax on jobs, the national insurance surcharge, during the present Parliament. They talk a lot about unemployment. They didn't hesitate to put a tax on jobs, which made the position worse. We've taken off $2 billion and put it back into the private sector. We can help to cut costs on business through limiting the increase in local authority rates. Rates are now the biggest tax borne by industry. And in a major city I recently visited, one-third of the city's firms were seeking to move out in order to avoid a rate burden which for some of them approached £2,000 per employee. Early in the new year, we shall introduce a bill to control the rates set by certain high-spending authorities. We shall seek reserve powers to limit rate increases for all authorities should it prove necessary. And very welcome that legislation will be, not only to domestic ratepayers, but to industry and commerce alike. But some of the reforms I've just mentioned already apply to Scotland, and my right honourable friend, the Secretary of State for Scotland, will be presenting separately the evaluation and rating reforms he proposes for Scotland. We shall also bring forward proposals to abolish the Greater London Council and the Metropolitan Council, which have been shown to be a wasteful and unnecessary tier of government. I give way to the honourable gentleman.
Grateful to the Prime Minister, Mr. Speaker. In view of the Prime Minister's determination to take from the local authorities these very important powers that the local authorities have had down through the years, can the Prime Minister explain to the House what the purpose of local authorities will be after she has assumed her dictatorial powers over them?
Mr. Speaker, it is the responsibility of the Chancellor of the Exchequer to try to determine the overall level of public expenditure and the proportion of national income which is taken by public authorities and taken out of the pockets of the people. In recent years, the expenditure of local authorities has gone up enormously. There used to be certain customs and conventions which governed the relationship between local and national government. In recent years, those conventions have totally broken down, and it is that reason which leads us to take powers to limit the increases on rates, and that view has been overwhelmingly endorsed by the electorate. Cutting costs in all these ways is our first element in strategy for jobs. Secondly, we can use the tax system as a positive instrument to encourage the creation and expansion of small businesses and as an incentive to efficient management. The finance bill we introduced before the election went far in this direction, as indeed did previous ones. We shall introduce another bill immediately to further this work and to restore the tax reliefs which the opposition before the election deliberately withheld from nearly 1 million people. Thirdly, by continuing our substantial... I will give way.
Grateful to the Prime Minister, but since earlier in her speech she explained the Building Society's decision today in terms of the very great increase in the demand for mortgages, will she tell the House now whether she intends to persist with the three-month-old decision, taken in very different conditions, to raise the threshold for mortgage tax interest relief, which would therefore increase the demand for mortgages?
Had the Honourable Gentleman just listened to what I've said, he would have heard that we are going to reintroduce that bill. If he looks back at the debates which governed the limitation on mortgage tax relief at the time, he will be amazed that the level has not actually been raised before now. He will also know that in the cities, in the big cities, in the southeast, some one-third of new mortgages are of more than £25,000, and the failure to have extra tax relief is a very great burden on young men. Note, he wishes to continue that burden. We do not. The third point of our strategy, Mr. Speaker, is by continuing our substantial support for new technology. My honourable friend, in moving the address, spoke very much of the need to adapt to change. We have to if we are to succeed in the new and modern world. And to those who are fearful of industrial and commercial change, we point out that the real threat posed by the new technology is that our competitors may use it and we will not. And this is one of the biggest challenges we face. We look at Japan, which is ever quick to adapt new processes and adopt new techniques. But her unemployment rate at 2.5% is the envy of many, and yet a smaller proportion of her workforce is engaged in manufacturing than ours. She has only 25% engaged in manufacturing against our 27%, and that proportion, like ours, has declined. Mr. Speaker, new technology will only flourish in conditions of competition. We've already ended the monopoly in telecommunications, and we shall reintroduce the bill to denationalise British Telecom. With all the support we're giving to new technology, to launch new products, and indeed to bring about new research between, with a combination of the universities, government and industry, we are in fact pointing the way to Britain being in the forefront and one of the leaders of technological advance. Our traditions point that way, our skills lead that way, and our policies are taking us that way, and must if we are to get the jobs and new products of the future. And the fourth point in our strategy for jobs and for recovery is by extensive systems of training. Without an adaptable and highly skilled people, our economy cannot achieve its full potential. British industry clearly accepts this analysis and our chosen method of improving training for young people. 460,000 places are needed for the new youth training scheme, one of the most advanced ever seen in this country. I am glad to tell the House that 415,000 of these places are already identified. And fifthly, Mr. Speaker, the fifth point in our strategy is by taking forward our programme of trade union reform. All too often, Mr. Speaker, we hear trade union leaders defend overmanning and inefficient working practices as if they were defending their members' jobs. But the truth is that by holding down productivity and preventing the introduction of the more efficient working practices which our competitors take for granted, the trade unions are actually destroying the very jobs they claim to defend. And it's because trade unions are such powerful agencies for good or harm, for creating new jobs or destroying existing jobs, that we are convinced of the need for ensuring that this power is used democratically and responsibly. That was the theme running through our 1980 and 1982 Employment Acts, in which we curbed the abuse of arbitrary power in the closed shop by providing for shop floor ballots, and on the picket line by making secondary picketing unlawful. These measures have enjoyed the support not only of the British people as a whole, but also of a large majority of trade unionists. Now we shall move forward along the lines set out in our 1982 Green Paper, Democracy in Trade Unions, to ensure that the ballot box and not the bully boy shall prevail. We shall give their fully in support of what we're doing. We shall give union members the right to hold secret ballots for the election of governing bodies of trade unions. We shall give them the right to decide periodically by ballot whether their unions should have party political funds. And we shall also curb the legal immunity of unions if they call strikes without first securing the prior approval of those concerned through a fair and secret ballot. That is our strategy for jobs and for recovery. May I just go through the 5 points again? A strategy which government can help to cut costs on business, in which it uses taxation as an incentive to enterprise and efficient management, in which it has extensive programmes for supporting new technology, in which it has extensive training programmes, and which it embarks on trade union reform. This is a strategy which tackles fundamental problems. But, Mr. Speaker, neither these measures nor any government measures can guarantee a recovery or the creation of the new jobs we need. But they help to provide opportunity. Opportunity which can be grasped only if our industries, workforce and management alike have the will, the vitality and the flair to produce the products and the services that will sell. That is the nature of the essential partnership between government and industry. And I believe there is now a much wider understanding of the link between the prosperity of our people and the performance of our industry and commerce. Mr. Speaker, the Right Honourable Gentleman, the Leader of the Opposition, spoke of the welfare state. Let us be clear, there is no conflict between more profitable business and the range of social provision and care which we all wish to see. Indeed, the one competitive and profitable business is the essential condition for the care and provision we all wish to see. Did the Honourable Gentleman wish to interrupt?
The Right Honourable Lady, if she expects to get the revolutionary advance in productive technique without the cooperation of the trade union movement, and what does she envisage about the extent to which she will expect to consult the trade union movement and the General Council of the TUC?
The TUC, the trade unions, are always consulted and were consulted over the Green Paper, which we previously introduced and will also be consulted. But the point of much of what the legislation will contain this time is to give the ordinary members of trade unions a bigger say in the life and work and decisions of their trade union. It'll be very strange but not surprising if it's severely opposed by Honourable and Right Honourable Gentlemen on the other side. I was speaking about the welfare state and the need, in order to finance it, to have a thriving and flourishing private sector which is competitive and make profits. The need can be shown if one looks at a number of figures. To increase the retirement pension by £1 a week, we need £350 million of extra revenue. To build a new 300-bed hospital and run and staff it for 3 years, we need nearly £50 million of extra revenue. To reduce the basic rate of income tax by one penny, or raise tax thresholds by 5%, or to increase child benefit by £2 a week, calls for an extra £1,000 million every year for each of those things. And that is the challenge which faces us. The welfare provision which we all want can only be provided through industrial and commercial success. We have protected and shall continue to protect the social services. The absurd scares put about during the general election served only to give us the chance to spell out our magnificent record in the social services. the fiercest world recession for 40 years.
Yeah. Mr. Jack Straw,
in view of this magnificent record, does the Prime Minister guarantee to uprate unemployment benefit in line with prices?
Speaker, nor indeed did I give that guarantee during the election, as the Honourable Gentleman knows full well, and of course as he heard someone else make a point of that during one of the previous speeches. Our approach goes further than protecting the weak. We aim to give the British people the opportunity to aspire to and achieve greater personal responsibility and the pride of ownership. That people should be able to own their own homes is at the heart of our philosophy. The link between liberty and property ownership goes deep in our history. And that is why we are proud that during our first term, 1 million more families became homeowners, giving them a stake not only in the present but in the future. And 500,000 of those families were council tenants. We gave those council tenants the right to buy their homes in the face of ruthless and prolonged opposition. We shall continue to pursue that great social reform, and we shall extend to the many the chances and choices which were previously reserved for the few. The bill introduced in the last Parliament will shortly be brought forward again. Mr. Speaker, the domestic programme outlined in the gracious speech is a substantial one. On the international scene, we begin this Parliament at a time when the major industrialised countries are seeing clear signs of recovery and growing confidence in the prospects for that recovery. Perhaps the limitation factor, one of the limiting factors on the rate at which it can go, will be the problems in which a number of the developing countries find themselves because of debt, because international debt remains disconcertingly high. Nevertheless, over the past 12 months, the international financial community has acted with speed and skill in handling individual countries. There will be difficult, even critical times ahead, but with the growing recovery, interest rates well below peak, and the more prudent policies being pursued both by the debtor countries and by the lending institutions, the prospect is better than it was 12 months ago. Mr. Speaker, Britain has contributed to that improvement, and other countries cite the British example as the one to follow. We speak with new authority, and so are better able to pursue our aims and defend our interests. Mr. Speaker, freedom and justice are our most priceless possessions. We value them for ourselves, and we aspire to them for others, because the cause of freedom and justice knows no national boundaries. And the more widely freedom and the rule of law become established in the rest of the world, and trying to give freedom to individual members of the unions to have more say in the rights of their unions and justice to people. The more widely freedom and the rule of law become established in the rest of the world, the more secure they are at home. We shall defend them always, but we cannot defend them alone. We need allies. We shall continue to support and strengthen those alliances and partnerships which work for freedom. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which for so long has kept the peace in Europe, is the surest guarantee of that peace for the future. The European Community, founded on the desire to end war in Europe forever, is now a vital area of democracy and stability, which in an uncertain world we seek to preserve and extend. At the same time, we cherish our relationship with the United States, that great citadel of liberty and justice, which has shown over the years unparalleled generosity to the peoples of Europe and the wider world, and is the mainstay of the defence of the West. Our values, our way of life and security depend on these alliances and partnerships. I give way if it's something on this point.
Mr. Alan Beath
If she believes, as I do, those words she has just uttered, why does she believe that circumstances might arise in which she might have to launch a nuclear war because the Americans had refused to do so?
The Honourable Gentleman has completely misunderstood. We keep an independent nuclear deterrent as a last resort. It is there to deter, so that at no time should this country ever be in a position of being threatened by anyone who has nuclear weapons. And we, if we did not have them, the only alternative would be surrender or capitulation. That is not a course of action which we indeed would take. Mr. Speaker, our values and our way of life and security depend on those two alliances and partnerships. They've met and surmounted challenges before, and they'll meet fresh challenges in the coming years. For the West is confronted by a power which has failed to solve its own internal problems and seeks escape from these in ever-increasing military expenditure and display. There was a time when countries of the developing world criticised what they regarded as Western imperialism and looked to Moscow for aid and support. But the world has changed. It has seen the new imperialism at work in Eastern Europe, in Afghanistan and Cambodia. It has learned the lesson that it is the West which supports the rights of peoples freely to choose their own way of life, their governments and their policies, and the Soviet Union, who are the new imperialists. It is the West, too, which has shown the route to economic prosperity and which has provided economic aid to help the poor of the world. This is a time for the Western democracies to recover the confidence that some were in danger of losing, to redouble their efforts to defend and spread the values which have been tested by time and which offer incomparably more to mankind than the bankrupt ideology of Soviet communism. This government will stand firmly together, not only with its partners in NATO, but with its partners in the European community. The debate about British membership is over once and for all. Now we shall turn our energies to developing the community so that it can better serve the interests of all its members and further those interests in the outside world. That process was launched at Stuttgart last weekend. The public message from the European Council was that the discussion was dominated by budget matters. In part, it was. We were determined to secure a reasonable British rebate this year. But there was a wider significance. A process of fundamental reform has now been launched. First, the community has agreed a programme for firm decisions on its future financing, including, and this is vital for us, a fairer distribution of the burden. Second, we are now to examine in detail measures to curb the relentless growth in expenditure, especially in the Common Agricultural Policy. My honourable friend spoke about that when he was speaking about surpluses. Third, we are not prepared simply to agree that the community's resources should be increased. Just to deluge a problem with money is not a solution, but a substitute for a solution. So those who want more money will have to prove their case and show that the present resources are being spent effectively. I will give way on specifically on this point.
Favours.
Right Honourable Lady, the Prime Minister, give an assurance that she will not increase the VAT contribution to the community over the space of this Parliament.
Has the Honourable Gentleman been listening? I have said, in the last bit which I said, those who want more money in Europe will have to prove their case and show that the present resources are being spent effectively. Though the present resources are being spent effectively, we will consider the case, but we remain to be convinced. And as was indicated in the communique, which is indeed has been placed in the library, we could not possibly consider an increase in own resources, of which what the Honourable Gentleman has mentioned is only one particular method. Unless there were a fairer distribution of the burden, unless there was strict control, not only of agricultural expenditure, but also of other policies in the community. I have made it perfectly clear that we will consider the case, but we are not committed in any way whatsoever. We now have a golden opportunity to devise a reasonable and equitable basis for the community's finances so that the problems which have bedeviled it in the past do not recur. And there is now a real prospect of an effective, outward-looking organisation of European states, well designed to bring about a more prosperous future for its people and to carry its benefits to a wider world. We have worked for this opportunity for 4 years, and we shall make the most of it now that it has arrived. But, Mr. Speaker, all the achievements we seek, both at home and abroad, will be at risk unless we and our allies maintain adequate defences. We threaten no one, we do not seek superiority, but we must be strong enough to deter. And this government will do all in its power to ensure that together with our allies, we have and retain that strength. We'd like to maintain our security at a lower level of arms and expenditure. But it's no good disarming in the vague hope that the Warsaw Pact will follow our example. History shows that one-sided gestures are at best futile and at worst dangerous. The British people have seen through the arguments for one-sided disarmament. They've rejected proposals that would have weakened this country's defences and those of our allies. The right course is multilateral disarmament. We shall examine every proposal from the Soviet Union with an open mind. But an open mind does not mean a simple mind. We shall examine every proposal rigorously and test it against our clear criteria. It must improve, not worsen, the balance of forces. It must preserve and not prejudice our way of life. Arms control agreements must be properly balanced and strictly verifiable. Meanwhile, Mr. Speaker, the West has tabled a whole series of disarmament proposals. If they are accepted by the Soviet Union, the world will be a better place. They are our proposals. It is up to them to accept them. If they are accepted, the world will be rid of the threat of chemical warfare, in which they have a vast superiority, and these horrible weapons will have been banned and destroyed. If they are accepted, a complete class of nuclear weapons, the intermediate land-based missiles, will be eliminated. If our proposals are accepted, holdings of strategic nuclear missiles will be halved and warheads reduced by at least a third. If they are accepted, the conventional armed forces in Central Europe will be reduced by hundreds of thousands of soldiers and airmen so that equality exists between the two sides. And that would only be the beginning. The mistrust and fear on both sides would diminish, and we could go on to agree further balanced and verifiable reductions in the armaments of both sides. The prize is great, but we cannot hope to achieve even a small part of it unless we maintain our guard. We will work for peace while we defend our freedom. I have spoken, Mr. Speaker, about the main themes of the gracious speech. It shows a continuing purpose with its 4 predecessors and with those which I am confident will be presented to this House for many years to come. For we are engaged upon a deliberate and sustained endeavour to harness change to our advantage, to liberate the inventive genius of our people, and to uphold the law and defend freedom and justice. We have dared to address Britain's basic problems. We have dared to persevere, and we are proud to have received the endorsement of the British people.